Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinny Eastwood Show. We're broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and, incidentally, the VinnyEastwoodShow.com. You can listen in the homepages or listen live flash player there. And if you are keen to chat with others of like mind, we have a chat room. You just Google Vinny Eastwood chat. The CIA knows where to find me, and now so do you. My very special guest is Andrew Bruschango from Project Pegasus. Now this man has some very, very weird experiences. Doesn't mean they ain't real. If anything, what my conclusion about life is, that truth is far, far stranger than fiction could ever be. And in fact, most of the works of fiction are instead based on real events and truth in and of itself. This is the world we live in, ladies and gentlemen. It's messed up. Don't be naive. Andrew Bruschango from Project Pegasus, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Vinny. You know, that phrase, the truth is stranger than fiction, actually is attributed to Samuel Langhorne Clemens, the novelist Mark Twain, who I know the Chinese believe is one of the most brilliant Westerners, and I happen to think so as well. I mean, there's actually a lot of depth to Mark Twain's writings and his most famous aphorisms, that being one of them.
Well, my favorite Mark Twain quote is, when an honest man is confronted that he is wrong, he will either cease to be wrong or cease to be honest.
Yeah, there you have it. So, you know, we say that a lot, but it's actually a proverbial phrase of Mark Twain that no longer gets cited to him. So I just thought I would cite it to the great writer Mark Twain.
Well, I'm just going to add that into my little phraseology goodie bag for usage later. Thank you very much, Andy. Right. Now, your personal story, and we've had you on the show before. However, what I would like to do during this 2 hours that we have is not waste any time. And essentially, I wanted to get a personal story from you about the time travel experiments and the things that you've done and the things that you've seen. Just specifically talking about things that have happened in the past, not necessarily looking at perhaps nowadays with the demonization that you're receiving on the part of both mainstream and alternative media, and of course your rise to prominence and more or less a form of fame on George Norrie's Coast to Coast. And I'd like to get the backstory on how that all came about before we start talking about it. You know what I'm saying?
Well, do you mean how it came about in childhood or just this sort of recent media?
In childhood.
Okay. we're not really sure why I was selected for Project Pegasus. We know that Project Pegasus was a classified defense-related research and development program under DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. There were dozens, if not hundreds, of significant defense projects during the Cold War in the United States that had nothing to do with building the next most effective round of nuclear warheads. The one that I was in emerged sometime in the mid-1960s, and there was a decision to scour every available source to give the U.S. government a time-space exploration capability. Now, this had its roots in the counter-response to the extraterrestrial situation, which began in October of 1952, after the July 1952 overflight of Washington, D.C., by nine flying saucers that were tracked at traveling at 7,000 miles per hour. So we have to view Pegasus as not just the way in which Nikola Tesla's work was exploited for the 25 years after, or developed for the 25 years after his death in 1943, but also as an ongoing effort to sort of match the extraterrestrials in terms of their technical capabilities. We were observing the fact that they weren't flying between point A and point B in the sky. They were often just stopping being at point A and starting being at point B. So a kind of an intelligence funnel was created on a multi-agency basis with significant involvement by DARPA, the Central Intelligence Agency, and the Navy. And there's sound reasons for each of those. DARPA, of course, was the leading defense technical agency and still is in the United States. It's done far more than just these silly projects that are reported periodically in the science news, you know, that they found a way to, you know, glue cameras to the back of bumblebees. They've been doing very sophisticated things. CIA was involved because the intelligence that would be collected about past and future events was being published in secret reports that were being circulated among top intelligence officials and also need-to-know people on the project. And, of course, the Navy had ambit for time travel experimentation going back to World War II, because in the same way that the Navy is responsible for detecting threats across the horizon of the oceans, you know, the United States is a continental country that's surrounded on two sides by vast oceans. So the U.S. Navy was responsible to the U.S. government for detecting threats over the physical horizon of the Earth. And with the advent of time travel during and after World War II, the Navy became responsible for potential threats in the future. So it was responsible for what I call quantum access. And the reason I use the phrase quantum access is that time travel involves physical travel, bodily travel to the past or future, or some sub-variant of that. But if you're talking about not just remote viewing, but also technical remote viewing, or what I call chronovision, you're talking about not just bodily moving time travelers to the past or future, but simply detecting things holographically. So quantum access includes information gathering that's done physically by time-traveling espionage agents, but it also involves basically lensing non-local events into the laboratory and deriving information about past and future event scenarios that way. Okay, so with those three agencies and with the Ralph M. Parsons Company and the maybe lesser involvement by companies like General Electric and Bell Labs, there was a program that developed around the mid-1960s. It was clearly operationalized in terms of its teleportation capability by 1967-68. And in the late 60s, especially in the early 70s, especially around 1970-71, by then it had already developed eight forms of quantum access. Now, I was brought into Project Pegasus sometime between September of 1967 and September of 1968, because when I first teleported from the Curtis Wright Aeronautical Company in Woodridge, New Jersey, to Santa Fe, New Mexico, with my late father, who was an engineer for Parsons, which was the major defense contractor involved in the U.S. time-space development project. We drove from Santa Fe into a meeting at the Los Alamos National Labs with Dr. Harold M. Agnew, one of the Project Manhattan physicists. He had been the prize physics pupil of the great Dr. Enrico Fermi at the University of Chicago. When the atomic pile went critical, he was present at Los Alamos and Alamogordo, New Mexico, when the atomic bomb was constructed and tested. And he even calculated the blast over Hiroshima in a plane that was following the Enola Gay. It was a plane called the Great Artiste. So Agnew, in a sense, was the quintessential Project Manhattan physicist. And we were jumping into Santa Fe, however, even though a lot of our contact was with Agnew at the Los Alamos National Labs. And the return teleport, for that matter, was at the Sandia National Laboratory near the Kirtland Air Force Base, northeast of Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I once asked my brother, Dad, why are we always jumping into Santa Fe like this and taking a car to Los Alamos to meet with Dr. Agnew? And he said, because somebody at the labs may see something. And that's very telling, because that indicates that the very atomic research community agencies in New Mexico that were giving the U.S. government a time-space capability, in concert with very, very talented cadre of engineers at Parsons and companies like it, they were literally hiding the program from the Soviet spies that they knew had infiltrated the Los Alamos National Laboratory. The laboratories, I should say, it's plural. So Project Pegasus, unlike Project Manhattan, which had 64,000 employees during the war, Project Pegasus was limited to probably about 100 people. And in that first teleport to meet with Dr. Agnew, I remember him telling my father not even to save their lunch receipts because they didn't want a paper trail. In other words, don't do any expensing. Just periodically, you know, call us and tell us how much you need to be refunded on your expense accounts, because we don't even want you to keep written expense accounts.
Well, that would give them plausible deniability. What Project Pegasus? We've got no record of that, even on our own records.
Yeah, and that meeting with that, yeah, exactly. Was that small, and it was that unrecorded. In fact, at one time, they were keeping the project logs, which were these lists of names of people and when they had jumped into New Mexico and back to the East Coast via teleportation. At one time, the box containing those records was being kept behind the counter at the La Hacienda restaurant in Old Town Albuquerque, where a woman by the name of Connie Chavez, who had been a former love interest of my father, in fact, before he met my mother, he had hoped to marry Connie. But she was the cashier there at that famous Mexican restaurant in Old Town Albuquerque. And at one point, she and Wentworth Brown of the Brown family that owned that restaurant were literally keeping the project files for the teleportation project behind the counter. So that's how sort of off the shelf, off portfolio Project Pegasus was. It was a tiny secret project. Now, the thrust of it was to draw information from a variety of sources to give the U.S. government a quantum access capability. Now, those sources were ancient sources, like experimentation or actual reduction to practice by the Sumerian, Babylonian, and Egyptian civilizations, which we now know the high Egyptian civilization reached Mars in antiquity, because my own present research organization, the Mars Anomaly Research Society, has found the face of a pharaoh carved into a rock in one of the rover spirit images sent back by NASA from Mars. They were also collecting what they called foreign intelligence, which would be the experimentation by the Nazi German and Soviet Russian experiment. They were gathering extraterrestrial sources of information via UFO crash retrieval and human extraterrestrial liaison projects that the U.S. government was then involved in. In other words, they were gleaning information from the guests of our government who were either interdimensional or extraterrestrials staying in underground locations in New Mexico and sometimes coming up to the lab level to interact with our personnel. And I met several of those when I was on the project. And then also great contemporary sources, especially Nikola Tesla and Enrico Fermi. In fact, three of the project principals, my late father, Raymond F. Bishago of Parsons, Jack Pruitt of the Navy, who was one of the team leaders working with the children on the project, and Dr. Robert Beckwith, formerly of GE, who would go on to become a very prominent inventor and owner of Beckwith Electrical of Key Largo, Florida, of Largo, Florida. Those three gentlemen all confirmed for me when I was a child on the project that the project owed its greatest debt of gratitude to Tesla. Because what had happened is when Tesla died at the Knickerbocker Hotel in New York City on January 7th of 1943, you can find right in the conventional biographies of Tesla. For example, in Margaret Cheney writes about this in her book about Tesla. There were two War Department officials and two FBI agents racing to his flat there at the Knickerbocker to seize his shop manuals. Because Tesla was not just feeding pigeons during the last 15 or 20 years of his life. He had not lost his mind. What he was actually doing was doing drawings and schematics and mathematical formulae articulating the technology of the time-space age of the 21st century that we're now on the threshold of entering. He was virtually, well, he was, what, 80 years ahead of his time? And to the extent that we hope that teleportation will be operational on a global basis by 2020, that's the time, that's the year that I've set. So by 1940 or thereabouts, Tesla had given us, you know, essentially the teleportation technology that we will use to move around our planet in the 21st century. So the War Department officials got there first, and they seized his paperwork under the Alien Property Act, which was essentially a congressional statute that allowed U.S. federal agencies to simply pick up and take, you know, basically steal the documentation of creative people from their studios or laboratories when they were presumed to be non-naturalized American citizens. And that was a ruse because Tesla, in fact, was naturalized. In fact, he came to the United States in 1889 because he had solved a scientific problem that Thomas Alva Edison had posed. And so Tesla had been in the United States for decades at the time of his death. He came here as a young man. And instead of forwarding that documentation to Washington, it was under the order of the U.S. Army, it was directed to the most logical place where it could do any good, where the scientists could make sense of Tesla's work, which were the world's leading physicists, or many of the world's leading physicists, that were then gathering in Los Alamos, New Mexico, to build the atomic bomb.
Well, hold on, Andy. I'll stop you there. That's actually a good place to cut off and go to break, isn't it? Andrew Bishago, ladies and gentlemen, from Project Pegasus. You can go Google that up. And he's also on Facebook, which would be very nice for you. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. The way it's going to be. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. You can listen on the homepage there or in the chat room. Now, my very special guest, Andy Bishago. Now, you were talking about these bunch of research scientists that were given Tesla's findings or something?
Right. Tesla's shop manuals, his paperwork, his technical documentation, if you will, was forwarded to Los Alamos at the time that the Los Alamos Scientific Laboratory was being created in New Mexico, which today we know as the Los Alamos National Laboratories, or LANL as its acronym. Which was done ostensibly to build the atomic bomb, we were told, after the war. But in fact, they had also received Tesla's paperwork during the war. Now, when I first teleported to New Mexico, we drove up into a meeting with Dr. Harold Agnew, one of the Manhattan Project physicists. And there was a conversation between my late father, Raymond F. Bishago, and Harold M. Agnew that I think was historically significant. So this is a paraphrase, but this goes pretty close to what happened. I've done a huge amount of memory work over the last 10 or 12 years to reconstruct what I experienced, but this was a very telling I think this is a telling anecdote. We entered Agnew's office, and it was over on the far right side of the first floor of LAML. In fact, this was way before Homeland Security and 9/11, because we just had to pass one guard with a gun and a badge to get into the facility on my dad's DOD identification card. And we sat.
Yeah, and it's not like that anymore. It's more like Maxwell Smart with like those 17,000 doors that you have to walk through.
Yeah, there's probably iris scanning there now, and if your iris isn't on record, they probably shoot you right there or something. But my dad flashed his Department of Defense identity card, and we walked over to Dr. Agnew's office. And I know from his CV and from the timing here that he wasn't yet director. Agnew would become director of LANL from 1970 to 78. At this time, he had just left NASA, where he won some secret award from President Lyndon Johnson for something that he did at the space agency that has still not been revealed. It may have been accomplishing teleportation. But we waited. This was when he was the director of the weapons division, the so-called W division at the labs. And that's telling because that indicates that basically time-space engineering, or what we would call time travel, was sequestered in the weapons division of the Los Alamos National Labs, basically America's premier nuclear bomb making agency.
Well, I would presume that's because teleportation produces the means of an instant strike, and the vast majority of people that die in war are not the people in the war zone at all. They actually die on the way.
Right. In fact, teleportation was prioritized as a military secret for precisely that reason. They found, the U.S. Army found in its studies of battlefield casualties during World War II, among the Allies in the European theater of the war, that the majority of soldiers were killed or wounded not on the front lines, where they were wary about being shot or firing, and not in the rear areas, where they were too far back to even be picked off by snipers. But in fact, something like 60% of the battlefield deaths and injuries occurred in the middle ground when troops were being moved up from rear areas to the front line. They did things like fall into water and drown. They were shot from behind accidentally by friendly fire. They were picked off by snipers and so forth. So teleportation, it was hoped that teleportation would allow the U.S. Army to put troops precisely where they were needed on the battlefield without that threat of having to get to the front lines. And so, yes, it was also sequestered at the Los Alamos National Laboratories because it was a top military secret, like the atomic bombs that emerged during and after the war. So the conversation that was held between my dad and Dr. Agnew was very telling. He ultimately, after about 5 minutes, he came into his office. My dad, he said something like, "You have the prospectus." My dad handed him the sheaf of papers that he had taken even the paper clip off before we jumped through the test of device at Curtis Wright in New Jersey just that morning. Dr. Agnew started reading it. And he said something like, "It's fine, except the numbers, the financial figures." And my dad said, "Too low?" And Agnew said, "No, too high." And that's actually a pretty funny aspect of this, because Agnew was known for being the Jack Benny of the atomic research community. He was known for being so cheap that he wouldn't even pick up his own lunch.
Sorry, who, Jack Benny? I'm a young guy. I'm not familiar with that name.
Entertainer. Basically, the American comedian Jack Benny was known for being utterly cheap, and Dr. Agnew was kidded about being the Jack Benny of the atomic research community because he was such a tightwad that he wouldn't even pick up his own lunch at lunch. He would wait around for somebody in the party to pick up his lunch as the director of the lab. And anyway, so he was suggesting that my father's operational budget for the program to test and train civilians, including both adults and children in the teleportation capability, in the teleportation project that was emerging, was too high. Because my dad had basically put together a prospectus for that project. And then Agnew looked up and said something like, "How was your trip?" And my dad said, "Oh, fine and fast, Harold." And then Harold looked up at him kind of sheepishly, kind of with a clever kind of look, like an insider kind of knowing, and said, "Oh, did you take the teleporter?" And my dad turned to me. I was sitting next to my father on the right side. And he said, "Yep, and so did my number three son." which is what my father called me. That was like a running joke in our family. And then Harold looked over at me, and as you can find on my Facebook page, I was really a cute kid. I was only, 6 years old here. And Dr. Agnew asked me, smiled at me because I was a cute lad, and said to my father, "How old?" Into, asking my age. And I was always on top of my data, so I jumped in, and my dad and I said simultaneously, 6. So that's very telling because it indicates that Tesla teleportation that opens up a vortal tunnel in the fabric of time-space, was fully operational in the U.S. defense technical community without usual injury, although there were project casualties, but essentially with as much safety as automobile transport, for example. By September of 1967 and September of 1968, because I had to be 6 when we had that meeting with Agnew, we had teleported there. And then that little conversation kind of ended out when my dad said, "Have you tried it?" And Agnew said, "No, but I want to." And that indicates that this key insider, this Manhattan Project physicist that had been literally the protege of Enrico Fermi at the University of Chicago, knew of the existence of teleportation. It was a new application inside the U.S. defense technical community, the atomic research community, but he hadn't yet tried it himself. And if you consider the fact that 1967-68, the year that I was 6 years old, having been born on September 18th of 1961, was 25 years after Tesla's death, and yet the director of the weapons division of the lab hasn't tried it yet, that I think creates what we call in the law a rebuttable presumption that was the time of the emergence of this particular secret technology. So we had frequent interaction with Agnew in his office and at lunches. I also had interaction with Dr. Edward Teller at one of the project locations where he was fixing one of the time travel devices. I was standing next to my dad in the hallway at Lanel when he had a conversation with a third Manhattan Project physicist, another Italian by the name of Dr. Emilio Segre, and he informed Dr. Segre that we were there at the lab because we were on a teleportation project based at Sandia. So this is the provenance of the teleportation technology that Project Pegasus was working with, not just to test the children involved, but to sort of train us as the next cadre, really the first adult cadre of time travelers trained from childhood in the different forms of time travel that were emerging. The other major form of time travel were devices called chronovisors, which are electro-optical devices that propagate a hologram so dense that they have the effect of lensing a non-local event into the laboratory. When that form of moving, colored cubical cinema is tuned into the laboratory, in other words, when you literally tune in this moving cubicle hologram, if you look at the hologram, you have essentially a looking glass that allows you to see into the past or future, hence the later use of the phrase, not chronovisor, but looking glass, in the Dan Burrish testimony, for example, that Project Camelot developed. However, something that's been less emphasized by some of the other people who have discussed this looking glass technology is that when you stand in the hologram, when it's tuned around you, you spontaneously experience going to that time and place. In other words, chronovision, a chronovisor, is not just a technical remote viewing device. It is a time travel device. So those were the two major forms of time travel that they were working with me in, but there were actually a number of more rudimentary approaches to gathering information from the past and future, and several more advanced ones that I was exposed to during those 3 years. From roughly the fall of 1969, when I was officially brought into Project Pegasus, several years after I first teleported to New Mexico with my father, and then the end of the summer of 1972. So I guess the import of my story, and I'm going to live the rest of my years telling it because it's the truth, and that is that by 1970, that's a good date to really hang our hat on, by 1970, the U.S. government had numerous forms of time travel. They were fully operational. Their origin, structure, function was understood. And they were being utilized to send American personnel to the past and future. And I was one of those personnel because I was the part of the cadre of gifted and talented American school children who were being trained with the intent that we would later matriculate to the Naval Academy in Annapolis after high school and become America's first cadre of, you know, fully trained chrononauts. In the process, we became America's first cadre of chrononauts in the program because some of the devices needed small people to be involved. For example, when they were developing the chronovisor, the holograms were so sensitive and would so readily go on the blink from the respiration, the heartbeat, the footfall, the movements of a large human being, namely an adult, that they were literally using us as bright children to be the eyes and ears of the program and do the time traveling inside of the holograms that the chronovisors were propagating. So in those 3 years, I was exposed to 8 modalities of time travel. I'm describing in my disclosure effort what they were. And the thrust of my truth campaign around these technologies is, one, the people of the world need to know that we entered the time-space age back in the epochal year of 1968 when there was so much social ferment and political activism. Nobody was thinking about what we were doing with things like Nikola Tesla's papers in America's secret defense labs. And today, we could have already been teleporting around the world for the last 40 years. You know, the metaphor I use for that is, remember the stories about Al Gore first getting concerned about the greenhouse effect, as it was then called, when he was studying with Dr. Roger Revelle at Harvard College?
Was this during the 70s? Because I believe during the 70s, the fear was a global cooling, not global warming. They changed that to global warming and then changed it to climate change.
Right. Well, certainly the CIA under Andrew Marshall was concerned that if the greenhouse effect intensified, there would be a melting of the polar ice. It's basically the Art Bell Whitley Strieber coming global superstorm scenario, which is that with enough melting of the polar ice caps, the oceans will become less saline because of saturation with fresh water from the polar ice caps. The ionic heat exchange from salt in the oceans will fail, and the Gulf Stream will fail. The currents that bring warm equatorial waters up to the poles will fail, and then there'll be a cold snap, a new ice age. And that was a very real concern about the CIA. In fact, in my investigation of my experiences in Project Pegasus, I found out that the CIA has been concerned about 3 major threats to the United States and to the world for that matter, but to the U.S. as the political embodiment of, you know, of the CIA. And that is coastal flooding from polar ice cap melting. The second, the new ice age or mini ice age that could foment. And third, global militarism or hegemony by the People's Republic of China. Those have been the 3 major fears of the United States cryptocracy. And they've been manipulating events to address all 3 of those. This crash sort of time travel program was not just being undertaken to deal with the threat from the extraterrestrials. It was also done in the context of race riots in the United States, where there was a concern about black nationalism overthrowing the United States, a concern about how a hegemonistic China might upset the global balance of power, what coastal flooding would do to the world. Because look, 70% of human beings live within a 1-hour car drive of an ocean. If we have a global coastal flooding event, the world is going to be put back about 200 years. We'll be back in the level of material provision that the world was in 1776. Okay, so, we'll all be lighting a lot of candles, for example. But,
Well, hold on, Andy. We're going to come in to break it again. Andrew Brashango from Project Pegasus is my guest for the entirety of today's show. So we have another almost hour and a half with him. Thank you so much for sharing your time, Andy, because, I don't know. I want to make so many jokes about time travel and things like that and about your political campaign running as an interdimensional candidate, but we'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
People, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better. either start swimming or you'll sink like a stone.
Welcome
the
times
back. They are changing.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. You can even listen on your iPhone if you go to AmericanFreedomRadio.com, download the app. We have apps for Android as well, and interestingly enough, people are able to now have the little USB ports in your car, so you can plug your iPhone into that, tune in American Freedom Radio with the app, and you can listen to AmericanFreedomRadio.com and the Vinnie Eastwood Show while you're driving around live. How about them apples? My very special guest, Andy Bishago, going to be running for President of the United States. So, Andy, are you going to be running for as an independent or an interdimensional?
Actually, both, Vinnie. I'm going to be petitioning to get on every state ballot in all the 50 states. And I'm going to talk about my interdimensional experiences. I'm not an interdimensional. I'm actually just an ethnic kid from Morris Plains, New Jersey. But along the way, I've had some interesting life experiences. And I think to the extent that I was time traveling for the United States government and people as a child, I think in maturity, I think I'm certainly qualified to be chief executive. But I'm not going to pull any punches. I'm going to talk openly about my time travel experiences so that I can use my presidential campaign as a vehicle for bringing this information forward. I'm going to be discussing an entire platform, but I'm going to make U.S. leadership in declassifying and deploying our secret teleportation capability as the leading piece of my new energy platform.
So, getting back to what we were talking about before, you wanted to wrap up an Al Gore anecdote of yourself.
Yeah, I mean, just to put this in perspective, Al Gore in 1970 was sitting in Roger Revelle's class at Harvard College when Revelle was trying to inculcate the next generation with concern about what was then called the greenhouse effect, which today we would call global warming, climate change, what have you. Andrew Marshall had already written his secret report for the Pentagon indicating that enough global warming could pitch us into the coming global superstorm of Strieber and Bell, basically a scenario where there would be so much melting that we might have a new ice age. Now, the last ice age, the glaciers came down to the southern Kansas border on the continental United States. Imagine the destruction that would be done during that reglaciation to countries like, the Scandinavian countries, the United Kingdom, Russia, China, Japan, Canada, the northern United States. It would be devastating because that's where a lot of our technical and academic resources are based, in cities like New York, London, Tokyo, Beijing, Moscow, Stockholm. So it was very significant that that be undertaken. But the point I make is, look, Al Gore went on to become one of the most prominent statesmen of his generation in the United States. He reached the vice presidency, and then after the vice presidency, when he launched his international crusade regarding global warming, he was a recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize and an Academy Award and even a Grammy. I mean, he became a celebrated figure in his generation. But the truth of the situation, I'm not faulting Al Gore, but the reality of the situation is, at the time that he was first being educated about the greenhouse effect at Harvard, what was secretly emerging in America's atomic research labs was the principal technology to reverse global warming. Why do I say that teleportation is the most significant environmental cause of our time? In other words, declassifying and deploying teleportation is so important to the environmental movement and our environmental concerns. Well, 60% of greenhouse gases come from transportation. If we could introduce Tesla teleportation first between major world cities, using them to replace commercial airliners, and then begin filling in the rest of our transportation grid with teleportation, so you can go not just go from Sydney to Auckland in 10 seconds rather than 24 hours, but you can literally go from your home to the grocery store via teleportation, essentially obviating the need for the internal combustion engine. whatever.
The internal combustion engine has been obsolete for a very long time. There's currently no need for it, but the main principle behind its continued existence and manufacture, I believe, is because the Rockefellers own a large chunk of the oil cartels, and they don't want their people's dependence on them to disappear.
Right, and we are either going to break that lock on the energy paradigm, or we're going to have a catastrophe.
So well, speaking of which, if teleportation is an advanced technology, how much energy does it use to teleport an object from one point to another? Because we've seen in the movies how they'd have like a big generator or whatever, or half a city would go dark in order to use these devices in secret underground labs or whatever. Is it like that? Are they currently very energy thirsty?
They're very energy efficient. So just for example, this small Tesla teleporter that we were using to get from New Jersey to New Mexico when I was a child on the project, which was basically two elliptical-shaped armatures that were about 8 feet high and about 10 feet apart from each other on the shop floor. The left armature was attached to a control console that a single technician sat at and operated a rudimentary computer-like screen with a keyboard. The boom on the right, the armature on the right, was attached to a cord in the wall that was about the size of an industrial power cord that you would need to operate a smaller piece of industrial equipment. I'm talking about something like an industrial lathe or an industrial drill press. Now, I'm not an electrical engineer in the manner of my late father, nor am I a physicist. But what I'm saying is that we were jumping through there and getting 2,005 miles west to Santa Fe, New Mexico, sometimes with an adjustment in weeks, months, or years in terms of our arrival. So the energy inputs of teleportation versus conventional means of transport are several orders of magnitude more cost-effective and less fuelish than our existing energy paradigm. And that's why
Well, and perhaps if we were to use some other classified, quote-unquote, free energy devices to fuel these, we would not only reduce travel time to zero, but energy consumption to zero. And then if everybody's got something of that nature, that would be really, really good for the economy. I mean, imagine the amount of people who get stuck in traffic for an hour or two every morning. Instead of that, they can spend that time doing something else, or even at work, continuing to work even more.
Right. There's a misconception about what's called the ephemeralization of technology, which is basically the capacity of technology to do more with less, fewer inputs, basically, of time, energy, and material. In fact, every time you essentially modernize your technical infrastructure in that way and maximize human freedom and convenience, you actually create wealth. Because I think you just basically provided a stellar example of this. There's nothing productive about sitting in a traffic jam for 2 hours. It wastes time, it causes stress, and it has negative health effects. For example, high blood pressure, diabetes, obesity, and so forth. So, in fact, and also, when new technology is introduced, if it is cosmically efficient, in other words, if it meets the cosmic efficiency test, it also meets economic efficiency tests. So, for example, when you can produce a good or a service less expensively, you can sell more of it and make more money in economic terms if they're defined financially, when cosmically you're doing more with less. So, in fact, we would prosper as a civilization if we made the transition to the new energy paradigm. We wouldn't, for every job that would be replaced, we would be creating jobs. So, for example, let's say the transportation and the shipping infrastructure. If we introduced teleportation for the shipping of goods, you would have 16-wheel truck drivers losing their jobs. But where would they be working? Where would they move? They would be operating the teleports to ship goods, and there would be more of them at those depots. Because with less costs, fewer transaction costs of shipping the same gram of product, you'd be shipping more product because it would be cheaper, and hence you could employ more people. So the path to new energy will actually be a net job creator. So what I'm going to be calling for when I run for president of the United States in 2012 is let's make teleportation the sort of the gem in the crown of our new energy infrastructure. And then let's do everything to find the ways and to cap, you know, to to solidify and bring into view and perfect all the ways that we can derive energy for free to drive the teleporter. So it won't even any longer be a question of where you're going to plug the teleporter in. You're going to be generating that free energy with the other applications that we know have emerged, but have not only been suppressed, but there's been situations we believe where some of the progenitors of these new energy technologies, like Dr. Stanley Meyer, have apparently been assassinated in order for these new energy technologies to be suppressed. And so we need leadership at the top level to bring about the new energy paradigm that has already emerged technically, but which now needs to be introduced socially, with, I believe, teleportation as sort of the central feature of that new economy, that new energy infrastructure.
And I think parenting as a occupation would change. I mean, how the hell are you going to ground the kids if they can instantly teleport to the other side of the country to go hang out with their mates? You know what I'm saying? We're coming to break. That's not a question I need you to answer because it's just stupid. I'm sorry. Ladies and gentlemen, you listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. My very special guest is Andrew Bishago. Bishago like Chicago on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And like I said, you can download the iPhone and Android apps. You can listen to it basically wherever you would like to. And join us in the chat room at the Vinnie Eastwood Show. And we'll see you all right after the break, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week, ladies and gentlemen. Next week is Thanksgiving, and I'll be taking that week after Thanksgiving off, and I'm going to have a bunch of, the best of in the last couple of months. Frank, you just have a look at the audio archives, like, man, we've had a lot of good shows in the last month alone. So to scroll through them and try and pick out the best of the best week for you, I can assure you, you're going to be wanting to listen to that, even if it ain't live, even if you've heard the shows before, because there's so many things about talking to the people that we do on this program that don't sink in right away. Kind of like watching a really intellectual movie, and when you watch it the second time, you see so much more, and there's a lot more dimension to it. You know what I'm saying? Andy Bishago is my guest, one of these very people who you should be listening to again and again to try and soak up this story and the reality of it. Because basically, if you think you know what's going on, that's when you know that you haven't got anything figured out properly. That's my perspective. The wisest person is the one who realizes how dumb he truly is, essentially. Andy, welcome back.
Good to be back, Vinny.
Now, what were we talking about before we came up from the last break there?
Well, I was talking about the fact that when I run for president, that the centerpiece of my new energy platform is going to be declassification and deployment globally in an international program of technology transfer by the United States government of the secret Tesla-based Vortal teleportation technology that it's concealed within the inner realms of the U.S. government for at least 45 years. Because I'm 51, and it was at age 6 that I first teleported with my late father from New Jersey to New Mexico around the time that DARPA's Project Pegasus was being launched. And in biological and anthropological and social terms, a human generation is 20 years. That's around the time that people can leave their parents' household and get married and have children themselves. So we've had a multi-generational cover-up of an incredibly valuable technology that we could have been using to get, for example, between major world cities in seconds around 1970. There's been a 42-year cover-up if we were to date the operationalization of the technology in 1970. And that's simply unacceptable. And that's the principal reason I'm speaking out about the time travel program. I'm not endorsing the notion that the mass public should be able to access mass timelines, you know, with mass time travel, because that would result in mass chaos. But I am calling for the introduction of Tesla teleportation for real-time transport, because there's no longer any need for us to be, strapping 4,000 pounds of metal around our waist and driving down the street. These are antiquated technologies. We are stuck in the 70s. You know, so when you go into a family restaurant in the United States, you hear a James Taylor song on the Muzak, right, at a Denny's or something. Well, we're also stuck in the 1970s in terms of our transportation infrastructure. All they've done is make the cars a little smaller and a little more futuristic looking. We're still dealing with the same outmoded internal combustion technology. So to that extent, Mr. Gore was right in his book, Earth in the Balance, when he made that statement. It was very true. But we can't just bemoan the fact that climate change is upon us. We need a response. Every historical challenge requires responses. And it's my conviction that one of the principal responses is the introduction of this secret technology into society at large. It would be very beneficial.
Well, I always thought about this phrase, something about the journey being the best part, not the destination. With teleportation, it'd be great because you get to cut out the middleman. And the only reason why people are really trying to say, oh, the journey is what really counts and getting there or whatever, is because they don't have a choice. They're either stuck in traffic and they have to rationalize and figure out how much better everything could be if this stuff didn't exist. And here we have it. And I've been a sci-fi fan for a long time, and I had this idea of a military and a domestic application for what I called time travel pads, kind of like about the size of a doormat or whatever. You step onto it, you tell it which location or which other pad that you want to jump to, and it sends you there. But before it sends you there, it sends a message to that other jump pad. Like, let's say, for example, you're going from your house to your friend's house across the country, and you just wanted to, you know, knock on their door and pay them a visit. So you dial in your doormat, and then their doormat rings, and as soon as they open the door, your doormat goes green, and you go bling straight through. So if they don't want to answer the door or they're not home, it'll just ring for a few seconds like a telephone, and then say no response, and you can't come. And that ensures a security lock on it, because one of the other things that was concerned to people who I told this idea was, what if somebody tries to burgle your house using the teleportation technology? And I say, well, you've got to have a shield or whatever, because imagine, Andy, that there was a teleportation pad in a bank vault or something of that nature, and how easy it would be for a high-tech criminal to just go, grab a whole bunch of stuff, and then cha-ching, he's out again. So it produces a whole world of legislation that might actually be introduced in order to ensure the safety and the non-criminal use of such sophisticated technology. Much as it's illegal to hit somebody with a car, it's illegal to sabotage somebody's teleportation pad at their house so that it shreds them into a pink mist when it turns on.
Well, there's really two issues in that area. If we're talking about how the advent of teleportation secretly over 40 years ago relates to security issues. So let me just address those on the macro level and then on the micro level. At the nation state level, there is a national security interest on the part of the major nations that might be invaded via teleportation by, for example, an aggressor nation, a terrorist cell, or an organized criminal network to establish a teleportation infrastructure. In the same way that, for example, if a policeman is separated from his squad car in the United States, I don't know if it's true in other countries, but a policeman can commandeer a taxi or somebody's private vehicle. So to analogize to the level of teleportation, if a significant teleportation infrastructure could be secretly built by a hegemonistic country, by a terror organization, or by a group of organized criminals who would use it, let's say, to commit bank robberies and then teleport away from the scene of the crime. Therefore, it's in the national security of all of the major nations that would have assets worth invading via teleportation to launch an emergency program to establish a substantial teleportation infrastructure at the nation state level, because then they can occupy the field in time space and not be taken advantage of by surprise teleportation from some group of malefactors.
So that's kind of like having a radio frequency band that you pay for and nobody else is able to broadcast on that frequency.
Or like the motive that President Dwight David Eisenhower had in the United States after World War II, where he sponsored the legislation to build our interstate highway system so that soldiers and materiel and workers could be rapidly moved, let's say, from the East Coast to the West Coast. In other words, when you have an infrastructure that's greater than your potential adversary, the advantage that you have is to fend a surprise attack. I mean, if there had been enough time and big enough guns at the Pearl Harbor, all of the Japanese planes would have been shot out of the sky, right? So to analogize here, because we know that Tesla teleportation was fully operational secretly in the United States government, and we know that the Klaus Fuchs spy ring, at a minimum, penetrated the Los Alamos National Labs with Soviet spies, and because there's been enough time for teleportation to be developed independently, based on the derivation of the same principles and the same devices. In fact, all of the major nations have a profound security interest in establishing a teleportation infrastructure yesterday. Okay, so I'm speaking out as a concerned citizen that we occupy, when I say we, that the lawful, law-abiding, nonviolent majority of countries and people inside of countries come into possession of teleportation so that we can fend the misuse of this technology by an aggressor nation, terrorist group, or criminal organization.
Andy.
Sir.
Has this happened before? Has a country in possession of time travel or teleportation technology used it in terms of a military strike or operation against an enemy?
No, but non-lethal weapons technology moved from its development by people like Dr. Eldon Byrd, who was a personal friend of mine, was warning the world about the fact that psychotronic weapons had been gone black. It went from basically his project for the Army and Navy to the CIA, and then into rogue elements of the intelligence community, and then into organized criminal hands. So we know that organized criminals in the United States have been using psychotronic weapons technology against individuals. And I'm analogizing and say, well, wait a minute. Teleportation technology could be used in a similar pernicious rogue way. And the only thing to fend ourselves from that would be a teleportation infrastructure that would be larger and more effective that would be in the hands of the government. Because the government is what you create to handle problems that individuals can't solve separately, right? You need government to solve abiding problems of social organization. So there is a macro security issue around the fact that we haven't developed an extensive teleportation network, and that is that those three types of organizations could do so and overwhelm us with troops, somehow shut down our access to time-space travel, and so forth, in the same way that you seize a military objective. A military objective could be seized in time-space, not on the terrestrial plane. On the micro level, there's the need for the kind of nuanced approach that you're describing, which is, if I can teleport from my home to the grocery store, I can teleport into a bank vault or into my neighbor's bedroom. So we're going to have to find ways to check the destination points, to block the destination points. And again, that would require government. So I'm not calling for everybody teleporting from their home teleport like the Jetsons, you know, had spacecraft. I'm talking about a government-administered transportation program like the commercial air passenger system, where the teleports would be at centralized locations, they would be under government authority, and the large teleports would be at where airports are, and they would be defended by armed guards in the same way that Heathrow is. So I'm not talking about the willy-nilly development of this. I'm talking about using this to make the technology of the 1970s obsolete and to implement more efficient transport, not to create a chaotic system where everybody would be able to teleport into
and also
to spy on their neighbors.
Well, you could convert the TSA into the teleportation security agency, and you wouldn't even have to change the designs on the uniform.
Well, as president, I put all we need at airports, which is dogs capable of sniffing out every form of contraband that you could take on an airliner, that we'd have the opportunity to do that, because you could get rid of the TSA, just put the sniffer dogs under the Border Patrol, and actually maybe evolve the TSA into the teleportation security agency, protecting the teleports and not having all of us undress at the airport, which is ignominious enough. But being so passive that, in a sense, we're being treated as we deserve, because we're not getting on our hind legs here and say, wait a minute, our fathers, our grandfathers' generation developed secret technologies. Let's implement them. We paid for them. You know, that was the argument that Governor Jesse Ventura made with me when I filmed his show, which is going to be seen in the States on next Wednesday on November 21st.
It'll be on True TV?
Right, on True TV. I'm appearing in his time travel cover-up segment on conspiracy theory with Jesse Ventura. He said to me, you know, I think you want this technology out because you were involved in its development with your dad, and it's obviously was a major part of your childhood. I want these technologies known about and then used because I'm something called a taxpayer. I mean, what the hell have we been doing giving the U.S. defense technical community trillions of dollars over 65 years for them to develop, in this case, a transportation technology that could be several order of magnitude more efficient in terms of time, energy, environmental effect, convenience, public health, public safety, only to keep it secret for 65 years? That's no kind of good society. That's not any vision of a good society. The American people, for example, have to work until May to make their own money after paying their federal and state and local taxes. Well, if their money is then going to technical boondoggles that are only boondoggles in the sense that the technologies aren't being socially applied to improve human society, that's basically an oppressive dystopian reality that we're living in, where the fruits of our tax dollars are kept back from us that aren't used to make our lives safer, more efficient, less costly, more environmentally benign, more medically safe. So I'm speaking out because the people have an interest in utilizing this technology to be advantaged in the 21st century. You know, I want to teleport from Seattle to London so I can then maybe take an electric car or bus up from Heathrow or Gatwick up to Cambridge to meet with one of my profs from Cambridge. I should have had the ability to do that if this technology had been implemented in 1970. I should have been able to teleport to Cambridge.
Well, hold on. And if we come to break again, we've got two more segments left, ladies and gentlemen. If you are listening, then please jump on your Facebook, jump on whatever social media you've got, and tell people to listen into the live streams at AmericanFreedomRadio.com and the chat room at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. We'll be right back in just a few minutes with Andy Bishago. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, yeah. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. The somewhat operatic 2 hours of talk radio right here on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And as I mentioned earlier, please download those Android and iPhone apps. And if you can, email AmericanFreedomRadio at ymail.com if you want to volunteer at the network, or if you wish to give them a donation for all the work that they do here, keeping the engines running. You know, do it now. AmericanFreedomRadio at ymail.com. They need your help, actually, at this particular point in time, a lot more than I particularly do. So if you're going to donate to either one of us, but you can't pick which, pick American Freedom Radio. I'm serious about that. Andy Bishago is my guest, and we had two questions in the chat room that I would like you to address. Firstly, how does the time travel technology or teleportation technology actually work? And two, is it dangerous? Like, are there associated health effects? Because there's a simple... A film came out recently called Looper. I don't know if you've heard this or seen it, but it's relatively interesting how they use time travel technology. The criminal element in the future use time travel technology in order to send people who they're knocking off, whacking, as it were, back in time to be executed in the past, and their bodies burned and completely disappeared. It's the perfect crime.
Well, the second part of your question goes to the redo involving of a timeline involving time travel from the future to the past. So let me just quickly address that first in light of Looper. Based on everything I experienced in Project Pegasus with different times of time travel, the cardinal principle we have to remember about interventions in a past event that are launched from a time traveler coming from the future is that those interventions occur in real time in the present of the past event that we're visiting and become part of the past that existed when we left the future to make that nonlinear transept back to that location on the linear timeline. So that's why I say that you can't go back to change the past. You can't, or a past event scenario, you can only go back to fulfill it, right? Because it happened when the past was the present. It's in the time-space continuum. Okay, so the notion of a redo, I actually have been defending this position because it's what I was experiencing in the program. I lost a major lecture date recently because my host wanted me to talk about the redo concept. You can't redo the past. You can influence past events, however. So, for example, when I was sent to Gettysburg on November 19th of 1863 from a time lab in East Hanover, New Jersey in the spring of 1972, to have the privilege of seeing Abraham Lincoln give the Gettysburg Address, which I ended up screwing up, and I didn't see Mr. Lincoln on that time probe, nor his address. I was there the day Lincoln was there, because that's the day they sent me to, via a technology called plasma confinement. Okay, so that's why I'm in the famous Josephine Cobb image of Lincoln at Gettysburg, because I was sent there that day. Now, when I was sent there, did I create a second timeline where suddenly I was in the Cobb image? In other words, before I jumped from spring of 72 back to fall of 1863, was there a version of the Cobb image that had been circulating for almost a century, for 98 years, without me in it? No, because I was sent there from the future on the same day that Lincoln was there. Okay, so there is no redo of the same timeline that you're leaving to go back to the past, because you're already implicated in its effects. Now, you can go back and change events and conditions, but they become the past that existed when you left to change it. So that's essentially another way of addressing the grandfather paradox. Okay, you're implicated in the very the past being the very past you want to change. It already exists. Okay. Now, your other questions, I think, are more provocative because they go to teleportation and the potential we have here to introduce mortal teleportation in our generation. What the Tesla teleporter at Curtis Wright was doing, I can give you the information that I was told that I know. I'm not a physicist, but I can describe what I was told. I was told that Nikola Tesla had discovered a form of energy that he called radiant energy that he never publicly demonstrated. It was not the ball lightning that he was throwing around his apartment when luminaries like Mark Twain and Andrew Carnegie were coming by and John Singer Sargent. It was a technology that he kept secret. It is a technology that is both latent and pervasive in the physical universe, and that when Tesla found a way to draw it out of the universe, out of the ether, as it were, he discovered, even going back to his famous stay at Colorado Springs, Colorado in 1899, that this form of energy has, as its inherent capability, the capacity to bend the fabric of time-space. The device itself that was found in his papers consisted of these two elliptical-shaped objects in which radiant energy was being broadcast between the two armatures. And inside the interior, the concave interior of the two booms, there were these tiny little portals of light in which a bluish-green light could be seen squiggling across the field of radiant energy. The field of radiant energy itself looked like, if you went up to about a foot away from it, looked like the black and white snow pattern, which we call raster on a television set. But if you went back about, let's say, 8 to 10 feet and looked at the field of radiant energy, it kind of looked luminous, sort of like water falling in a public sculpture, a water sculpture. It was actually fairly beautiful, I would say. And when we jump through that field of radiant energy, the pressure differential between the time-space continuum and that layer of energy, in other words, that field of energy that had been laid in front of us, caused us to punch a tunnel through the time-space continuum. It was bluish-white in color. When you look to your left or right, you saw intervening events rapidly going by you holographically. And you would very quickly see a pinpoint of light at the end of the tunnel. I remember sometime in the tunnel itself, we felt like we were going at a very great rate of speed.
So was it anything comparable to, say, the Stargate scene in 2001, A Space Odyssey?
I would say the closest that we've seen in mainstream media depicting it would maybe be the teleportation effect in Sliders. In other words, opening up a tunnel in time-space and having, essentially, according to the theory of relativity, at that point, you're going through a tunnel in time-space and the rest of the universe is being pulled past you. You're basically creating a hole in the time-space continuum, what physicists would call a null field. And the question then is, how do you breathe in a null field? Is it a vacuum? Well, it wasn't a vacuum because we were in it and because we had pushed in enough air to get a couple breaths of air that our bodies had pushed in front of us, and then that would dissipate. In fact, my dad explained that when they first set up one of these Tesla devices after the guy accidentally teleported to Africa and then started using Navy enlisted personnel to test the attributes and try to adjust the teleporter, the first three Navy enlisted personnel asphyxiated because they opened up too long of a tunnel for the amount of oxygen that they had pushed into the mortal tunnel with their bodies. So the best explanation I can give, because I'm not a physicist, and I readily admit that, I'm simply a time travel experiencer who is a lawyer and a public figure or activist.
Well, so on that basis, if I were to ask you mechanically how this worked, you wouldn't be able to tell me because you were a child and you don't possess the technical training to replicate such technology anyway, would you?
No, I can't give, for example, what the interior of the armatures was, but I can describe the locations where the teleporters were. And by the way, I found witnesses to the teleporter at Curtis Wright, and I also received information from government insiders about the existence of the program. So as president, I wouldn't be physicist in chief. I think that honor would go to somebody like maybe Thomas Jefferson. You know, I don't get up every morning like Jefferson and take the temperature and pressure, you know, and put it in my journal. I'm not a scientist, but I would basically order the General Accounting Office to find the technology and set it up in a lab in Washington where I could take, oh, I don't know, somebody like Energy Secretary Dr. Brooks Agnew to go check out the teleportation equipment and figure out how it was working. Now, in the case of the chronovisors, I've actually broadcast, and I've disseminated enough information about the chronovisors to actually cause someone to reinvent the wheel on that by revealing that the crystals that were in the crystal arrays through which an electromagnetic signal was being sent that was generating the holograms that were tuning in past and future events were made of element 83, which is bismuth. Now, somebody's going to take that information and start polishing bismuth crystals and start experimenting with sending an EM signal through them. And if not create the kind of elaborate hologram-generating chronovisors that we had in the project, at least develop some very interesting knick-knack for people's desks. Oh, you want to look at the Gettysburg Address? Well, let me tune it in. In other words, that's the critical information somebody needs to know about the chronovisor. Start experimenting with sending an EM signal through bismuth crystals, 8 octagonal arrays of polished bismuth crystals, and you may find, for example, a past event popping up in your laboratory. So I don't make claims to having every last answer, every last fact about the technology, but what I've given is what I was able to perceive and remember and retrieve from memory, which is a description of the technologies, the people who are administering Project Pegasus, the origin, structure, and function of the technologies when I was told what they were, the project locations, and then my time travel experiences to kind of give an overview of where we were in applied time-space physics by, let's say, 1970.
So have you ever conversed with other people who may actually have such a scientific skill base and skill set whereby perhaps speaking with you might give them ideas or things that they can work with and experiment on?
Well, there are 4 principal time travel theorists in the world at the academic level. They are Dr. Michio Kaku, Dr. Stephen Hawking at Cambridge, Dr. David Darling at Oxford, Kaku, of course, from the City University of New York, and then Dr. Ronald Mallett, who I believe is at SUNY, one of the SUNY campuses, the State University of New York. Mallett doesn't believe me, and he stated that in order for me to be deemed credible or just any kind of reliable witness, I have to proffer the technology because I'm making technical claims. And I'm sorry, but that doesn't pass evidential muster because direct testimony about eyewitness experience enters evidence as direct evidence. Somebody can say, yes, the bank robber was wearing a blue sweater. I'm saying, yes, I teleported from Curtis Wright in 1967-68. Okay. Now, Dr. Kaku is a little bit more interesting and complicated in terms of his background. I asked him before an appearance at the Committee to the Bridge the Gap, which is an anti-war and anti-nuclear organization in West Los Angeles, in the early 80s, what he knew about advanced applications in quantum physics. When I was a student at UCLA, an undergraduate at UCLA, and I was being coy because I actually was remembering my time travel experiences, and I was trying to see if he knew anything about those secret projects. And he very kindly explained to me that after he was a conscientious objector who refused to engage in advanced weapons development with Dr. Edward Teller, in other words, when he refused to become essentially an acolyte of Teller, helping Teller develop even more destructive thermonuclear weapons, he was blacklisted and he was denied access to the defense community's files, the technologies and the records pertaining to advanced applications in quantum physics. But nonetheless, Dr. Kaku went on and became one of our leading theoreticians about time travel, somebody who was deemed credible enough to appear on the show American Perspectives on C-SPAN and state that my claims about Project Pegasus are quote-unquote fiction. They're not. They're science fact. I was an experiencer in an actual secret defense project where these devices were reduced to practice. So Mallett and Kaku are basically time travel skeptics who are hewing to the government line of, yes, we have no time travel. In a similar way, the Britons, Hawking and Darling, are so stuck, as Mallett is for that matter, in their Einsteinian notions of physics. And by the way, all 4 of them are totally unaware, apparently based on their statements and their public statements and writings, of Tesla's discovery of radiant energy. That it's like trying to ask somebody who's never encountered water what swimming is. They simply are out to lunch. And I'm accusing all four of them publicly, I've done so, of simply misinforming the public about time travel. Because they're still talking about time travel as if it hasn't emerged yet. And they're arrogantly, none of them called me to interview me when I emerged publicly. Now, why is that?
Einstein once said, Andrew, that condemnation without investigation is the height of ignorance.
Well, I think it's the height of arrogance, too. I mean, look at who I am. I'm an American lawyer who has practiced law for 16 years without a client complaint, much less an ethical charge. I'm a graduate of two of the finest universities in the world, the University of California at Los Angeles and the University of Cambridge in Cambridge, England. And I have everything to lose by making false claims in the public realm, including my law license, my reputation. And neither of those four time travel experts contacted me after I began to make it clear that I was talking about actual lived experiences rather than science fiction concepts. And so I think that what we have here is a situation where the brightest physicists that are being used as the leading lights of physics and that whose ideas are being used to stimulate the imagination of graduate physics students simply do not know what emerged secretly. If they could have stood in that lab at Curtis Wright and seen the energy that was propagated between the two armatures of the telephone.
Well, you know what, Andy, I've got this idea, right, and I've had Miran Tavakoli from the Keshe Foundation on, and he postulated some really wild evidence and theories about space and time and all of this kind of stuff, sent it to Stephen Hawking, and then Stephen Hawking said, no, it's BS, and then published it in one of his journals or something as his info. So these people at the top are simply the ones trying to keep us all down. We'll be right back.
Welcome back,
ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're broadcasting live. I love AmericanFreedomRadio.com, namely because they've got a big enough network and a big enough audience so that when I interview somebody who's just so fracking fabulous that I just can't believe they're on my show, and I get to talk to them in my short period of life that I've gotten so far, but people actually also get to tune in and hear it, and it gets recorded and it archived as well. Man, we're American Freedom Radio. We love you. We love you lots. My very special guest, Andy Bashago. We wanted to address the final question here. Maybe if we go on further, we'll have a little bit more, but safety. Is teleportation and or time travel actually a safe practice?
It probably is now, but let me just give a cautionary note here. When it was emerging, or emerge in, and I was teleporting frequently between New Jersey and New Mexico and back, sometimes stopping in Solon, Ohio, in cases where the Vortal Tunnel was collapsing and we needed to be decanted to the Swage Lock Company headquarters in Solon, Ohio, to continue our journey east or west, depending on which direction we've been heading. It was a new, dangerous, and experimental technology. So during a briefing at the Cerritos Cultural Center in spring of 1971 by the defense attaché to Project Pegasus, who had served as a Navy aviator and he was a congressman from the suburbs of Chicago, a man by the name of Donald Rumsfeld, who would go on and become defense secretary of the United States, in that meet and greet where he was lecturing about 15 of us young teleportees, he said there have been questions about medical side effects. And he said, thus far, we've only detected that the teleportation technology, being inside the tunnel, leads to substantial dehydration of the human body. And so all we can urge is that when you arrive here, he also said, and you're arriving here in New Mexico, where the climate is by nature very arid. So all we can urge is to recognize that that's a factor, and that when you get here, we would urge you to take more trips to the water fountain and then more trips to the bathroom. Kind of made a joke about it. But what I had just witnessed outside in the hall was a child pulling the child in front of her out of the way. A girl pulled a boy out of the way because he was slaking his thirst for so long in the water fountain in front of her. We were all lined up, slaking our thirst because we were severely dehydrated. Now, when I stayed in White Rock in the summer of 1973, teleporting there with my father during the fall of 71, I overheard a conversation with my father in which he was explaining to his friend Connie Chavez that I was being given, quote-unquote, a horse pill. This was this big pill I was taking in the morning. In fact, I learned how to bolt my vitamins and stuff, you know, in one movement with this big pill that my dad was giving me at breakfast every morning. And I think that was to try to counter-effect the dehydration. My dad was also giving me shots of vanadium with a hypodermic needle in the left calf. And when I asked Dad, why are you giving me these shots? He said, to protect your teeth and bones from radiation. Now, relative to the health effects of the children involved in the program, I met in Santa Fe in June of 2003 with a number of intelligence officials who were helping me uncover the truth of what had happened to me. And one of those was Jack Pruitt, Carl Jack Pruitt of the U.S. Navy, who had been one of the team leaders on Project Pegasus, and he went on to become the research director of Project Montauk. He's a real person. My dad and I, well, I first met Jack in summer of 1967, and my last meeting with him was during this June 2003 clandestine meeting in the old Sweeney Auditorium in Santa Fe that has since been torn down. But Jack told me that the dehydration effects of the teleportation had evolved among the grown-up child teleportees into a disease that mimics diabetes. In other words, the mechanism that was creating the vortal tunnels had affected the mechanisms inside the human body that regulate metabolism. And some of the teleportees were becoming very, very obese, including his son Glenn, who at that time was 700 pounds and several years later would die of congestive heart disease and pulmonary edema. So there was an issue of a disruption in blood sugar metabolism. And so many of the child teleportees have high blood glucose levels. I myself do. I also have some problem with dehydration. But then again, I took that acne medication that was causing dehydration. It escapes me now. The acne medication that came out in the early 80s. So I have several reasons to be dehydrated, but I'm pretty much chronically dehydrated. That's why sometimes you'll hear me coughing. It's actually the upper part of my lungs becoming and throat becoming dehydrated. Among the adult teleportees who teleported with more rigid tissues than children, there was some development of heart valve defects because, for example, in the case of my father, the flaps of his mitral valve actually, I guess when they were sort of vibrating in the vortal tunnel, kind of fused together into kind of a butterfly shape. So there was also the risk that if you teleported into water, the specific gravity of water is greater than the specific gravity of the air. And in one instance, one of the boys that I teleported with lost his feet. His feet were basically sheared off at the ankle because he cleanly slid off his ankles when he teleported into a public fountain that had about 3 inches of water in it when I was on the project. And I witnessed that grave tragedy and his suffering. And that was also one of the things that motivated me to speak out. I figured that if a group of American school children could risk death and dismemberment, bravely participating in the development of teleportation, it should be made safe and used to advantage humanity in the 21st century. So those are the known risks going back to the project days. But it's my belief that teleportation is being used secretly inside the U.S. government, for example, to move the president, the vice president, their family members, and other high officials between U.S. military bases around the world, and that I believe that it has probably been made safe. I would say that all forms of transport involve risk. If you cross a stream, you can drown. If you walk between one city and another, you can perish from hunger or thirst or animal attack. Or be robbed, assaulted by criminals before you reach your destination. And contemporary forms of travel like automobile and air travel involve regular levels of death as a result of accidents. So I think we would have to weigh the efficacy of the perhaps the supplements people could take if they were regular teleporters against the accident rate for conventional forms of transport. It's my position that automobile traffic should be obviated because it involves too high of a risk. Every year in the United States, 50,000 people lose their lives and 300,000 people are injured, which is the rate of death and injury that occurred during the entire 13 years of the Vietnam conflict. So the United States, in continuing to rely on automobiles for much of our transport, both local and long distance, is incurring an accident rate in a given year that is the entire human carnage that our country experienced during the Vietnam War. So I believe that we should use that as a base point, you know, as our means of evaluating whether the potential side effects of teleporting are serious enough to not introduce teleportation for anything but moving inanimate goods. I think, but I think it has been made safe, because I do believe it was made safe, and that I was actually one of the human medical experimentees that was used to, in some way, to create that data, to figure out how to make it safe. But I believe it was ultimately made safe decades ago.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so time travel. Oh, sorry. Keep mixing up the time travel and teleportation. I mean, same principle behind it, though, isn't it?
Well, not all teleportation is time travel, because you can teleport in real time, and not all time travel is teleportation, because there are other technologies that we can use to bodily time travel. Sort of a Venn diagram, sort of overlap.
Well, where I was going with this is that, you know how some people are afraid of flying, and you tell them, hey, look, man, statistically speaking, you're far more likely to die in a car crash than you are to go down in a plane. So they're like, oh, okay, sweet ass, I'll go on the plane then. That's not that bad, I guess. Now you can say something, I'm really, really afraid about time travel and being cut off at the ankles. And you say, well, man, statistically speaking, you're far more likely to die in a plane crash than you are to die in a teleportation mishap.
And it goes to not just being in the air, because most aviation casualties are burn victims who are killed or injured on the ground, like when a commercial airliner is struck by another commercial airliner at the airport. So really that goes to the obsolescent nature of air travel. You're basically, as we found out on 9/11, a commercial airliner is a flying fuel bomb explosive device until the fuel gets spent as you near your destination. And then some commercial aviators actually drop their fuel and begin subjecting to the civilian population below to all kinds of autoimmune diseases, from arthritis to fibromyalgia to lupus, dropping all that kerosene in an aerosolized fashion over our heads. So air travel is not safe. There's the risk of blood clots, birth defects, miscarriages, cardiac and pulmonary embolisms, and nonetheless, it is an order of magnitude or two more safe than automobile transport, but teleportation will be even more safe.
Andrew, thank you very much. And your website's projectpegasus.com, is that correct?
My time travel website is projectpegasus.net.
Projectpegasus.net. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, you can check all that out. And there will be archives posted of this show at AmericanFreedomRadio.com, the VinnieEastwoodShow.com archives. You can it just says all shows are archived here. You just click on that button and we'll have those up for you as soon as humanly possible, as well as up on the YouTube channel, Mr. News, Guerrilla Media. That's Mr. News, like, hello, I'm Mr. News. Guerrilla Media, gorilla like a soldier, not like a rather large ape, although I am 6'4" and we have that tendency. Andy, thank you very much. And we'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com.